Good evening and welcome to the Oceano Community Services District Board of Directors meeting for October 28th, 2009. May I have a roll call, please, Gina?
Vice President Hill.
Here.
Director Dahl.
Here.
Director Dean.
Here.
Director Lucy.
Here.
And President Mann is out of town this evening. Please join us in the flag salute.
Ready? Salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Item 3 is public comment. Any member of the public may address the board on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of the board. The board will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, we cannot act on any item that's not on the agenda this evening. Would anyone like to address the board at this time? Okay. Hearing none. Item number 4, board member items for discussion. Pamela?
Nothing at this time.
Mary?
Oh, I always love this part of the agenda to come out the gate rolling here. I do have a couple things that I'd like to discuss, and I'd like to try to make it as briefly as possible. So for the people in the town, it's been close to 1 year since I got elected onto this board, and so I felt a certain... I feel a certain obligation to keep people informed as to where I think things are as a new elected official. And so I'd also like to point out, too, is that there have been little signs along the way, but being a new member, I really am not familiar with protocols and how things exactly work. But I do know that when you're elected by the people of your town or your city, there are certain things that happen immediately because you're held accountable. And one of them is you become a signer on your accounts. And on your checks, good policy is to always have two signers when you're dealing with taxpayers' money, nonprofit money, or anything to that effect. Well, I have to say that I was paraded with taxpayers' money. And I really looked to the senior board members and people who had been on the board for a while to kind of weave me through this, because there was no orientation. There was no, you know, there was a business card and a stack of books handed to me, and that was all that was said. So it had to be all by self-taught, and I have to thank Jim Hill profusely for going out of his way and spending his weekends with me explaining things to me, because there was minimal support from staff, and there was no support from other board members. We have a divided board. We can't deny that. It's quite obvious. So as I go through the warrants each month and people are voting on them and stuff, I only have part of the picture. I have what staff has provided me. I don't have access to the bank accounts. I only have check numbers and warrant numbers, but I don't have a clear explanation as to, I don't have an invoice in front of me, so I have no idea the check was for the right amount. So I started asking board members, when you sign the checks, do you look and see if the warrant number matches up with the amount? Now, when I went on as a signer, I was able to get that information, and maybe somebody will talk about that more in length later on. What I found, and I actually hold all of us accountable for this, because out of all the signers, you know, there's the process, I think, is what's flawed. It happens at the end of the meeting. People are very, very tired. They've gone through the warrant pack. They're trusting what the staff has put on the warrant pack, and they sign the checks, not looking at the amount of the check. Many times it will vary. So I took the check numbers and tried to get a little bit more information. The check numbers on our checks are irrelevant. They have absolutely no value whatsoever. What we use is an invoice number. But this board has been approving checks based on check numbers. And the check numbers don't match the amount of the check. And it took a CPA to figure that out because I was chasing check numbers. And I thought they were really, really important because that's what's listed in my warrant packet. Not because I don't know how it got through the system so many years, and it took me 5 days of being a signer. And I could never get to the bottom of it. So I guess I'm a little taken back by it all because I was led to believe that a check number would lead me to a check, and that amount would match what staff had put in front of us, and that's simply not the case. We're working off invoice numbers, so as directors, I think you might want to take this more, you know, others might want to speak to it. Some of you might have even known about it. You know, so, and just goes once again to show you how receptive new elected people have been. It hasn't been a warm greeting for me, but I have a really thick skin. So on that note, I'm going to thank you for letting me make those comments.
I'll have a little more to say about that as we come on the appropriate agenda items also. Vern, anything?
No.
I have nothing else at this time either. Brings us to item number 5, review and approval of the minutes. Comments on the minutes? I do have some comments on the September 23rd minutes on pages 7 and 9. Item number on page 7, it would be item number 9D Delta, which is interim funding for the period. It says ayes, and it, as it records the vote, and it shows a unanimous yes vote, when in fact I myself and I believe Director Lucy were opposed to that item. The item shows where it's, it shows the word says the board directed to staff to pay warrants. I don't believe that's correct. I think it should say the board directed staff to approve interim funding for the period on a 3-2 vote, and that's usually 3-2 rather than 3-2. But the I think it's critical that we record the no votes. Similarly, on page 14, attention to item number 9E. It says, after research, the new general manager will be the one to come up with a time frame and timeline when it's feasible to replace the AS400 computer system. So we're all waiting with bated breath, but I just note that that is in the minutes. On the September 30th special meeting, page 3, says Vice President Hill stated eliminating $100,000 through cutting staff by closing the office 1-2 days a week. That, while that might be a valid proposal, my actual proposal was to eliminate the position of administrative assistant and office manager. And that would not terminate staff members. It would eliminate those positions is what the proposal was. On the October 14th, 2009 minutes on page 5, I note immediately before it talks about the vote, it says Administrative Assistant Davis will provide the actual restricted reserves through 2008 and projected estimates through June 2009 at the next scheduled board meeting. So I would expect to receive those this evening, Gina?
No, you won't.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
once again. So I just make a little tick mark. I'm up a couple of months now that I've requested the reserve status for our financial reserves and have been unable to obtain any kind of report from the district staff. So I wanted to note that for the record. Are there any other comments on the minutes? Any comments on the minutes from the public? That, do we have a motion? October 14th as amended. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes 4-0 with one absent. Item number six, reports. First is the September report from administration. Gina?
Mr. September, we did the routine payroll, assisted with the, prepared the board and committee meeting agenda packets, finalized the monthly nitrate and selenium reports prepared by the utility operations supervisor, received fees and paper orders for water and sewer new services, and provided support for various functions. After mailing late notices in August, utility door hangers were prepared and posted on residences on September 4th. Services were discontinued on September 10th to 33 accounts which had not been paid by the deadline. Staff continued at that point to work on the various tasks required in preparation for and accomplishing the bi-monthly meter reading and getting the bills out. Staff provided support for the DMV program, which meant the scheduling of the October 14th DMV date, which was unfortunately the last time that they would make the run to Oceano. We've had a lot of comments from people saying that they wish there was a way that they could keep that service coming. Letters were prepared to utility customers regarding delinquent accounts and information on garbage services. We also sent out several requests for courtesy notice applications so that landlords could have their tenant get a copy of their bills. The necessary notifications were sent to the City of Aurora Grandy and the County of San Luis Obispo to notify them that OCSD would begin water service to Halcyon Estates and Grandy Mobile Manor on October 21st. And finally, the annual water quality emergency plan was updated and submitted to the California Department of Public Health.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Questions on the report? Public comment on the report? Okay, receive and file, please. Utility Department report, Phil?
I picked up all the papers I could find, but I can't figure out how to
get it. Oh, I got it.
I should say I picked up all the papers I could carry. I've forgotten how to read.
Like the water main. The crew exposed the problem and repaired the break. And we've already replaced that service line. Each of the crew visited a home under construction that has installed a new residential fire sprinkler system. This is a new plastic pipe. We are in the process of learning all we can about residential fire sprinkler systems. It is our job to be certain that the water service will supply adequate water volume and pressure to ensure that the new residential fire sprinkler systems will work properly. Routine jobs completed during the month included hanging 175 late notices, completing the non-pay turnoffs, reading the water meters, collecting water samples, test running the C-15 Caterpillar engine and generator. Other jobs included installing several touch read meters and completing maintenance on the 25 horsepower booster pump. One fee letter was prepared, and an alternate worker cut weeds and cleaned up in the yard at Well 8 and down in the retention basin on 13th Street. The district produced 79.9 acre-feet of water during September. This was calculated as 49 acre-feet of state project water, 25.19 acre-feet of Lopez water, and we pumped 6.7 acre-feet groundwater. The total amount of water produced in September 09 was 9.5% less than was produced in August, and it was 2.2% less than was produced 1 year ago in September.
Thank you, Phil. Comments on the report?
No.
Public comment on the report? Receive and file, please. Thank you, Phil. We have no fire items tonight. Utility items, 8A, cleaning and inspection of district sewer and water lines. This is the continuing disclosure of emergency declared by the board following the San Simeon earthquake. Is there any public comment on this item? Hearing none. Motion.
I move that we continue the disclosure of emergency declared concerning the cleaning and inspection of the district sewer and water mains.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we continue the declaration of emergency for district sewer and water line cleaning and inspection. May I have a roll call, please, Gina?
Director Dean?
Yes.
Director Dahl?
Yes.
Director Lucy?
Yes.
Vice President Hill?
Yes.
In the County Public Works Department. I work on countywide water resources planning as well as state water issues. And I'm here tonight just to provide some background and information on our efforts and how it applies to your efforts. Basic overview of what I'll go over tonight is the state water project in general, and especially with the drought buffer program. Some more information on that. Talking about water management efforts both sub-regionally in your area as well as our countywide management efforts and how those relate and will be incorporated into our countywide master water plan and the integrated regional water management plan for the county. Talk about the plan and also some grant opportunities that may be available. So what is the State Water Project? Basically, it conveys water from the Northern California watersheds to both agricultural users and urban users throughout the state. It's not just Southern California. There's also communities west of the Delta that take state water, such as the Solano County area and Santa Clara Valley Water Agency. So the California Department of Water Resources is the manages the system, and all of the entities that contract with the state for an allocation of state water are designated as state water contractors. So the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District entered into an agreement for an allocation of state water with DWR in 1962, and that's called the Master Water Supply Agreement. So they, at that time, the county estimated that they would need 25,000 acre feet a year of state water to meet their needs into the future. So they built the central the aqueduct down Central Valley, and they made a stub out for our coastal branch. It's at Devil's Den. It's in the triangle made by 41 and 46 and I-5 out in the valley there. And so they made a stub out with capacity for that 25,000 acre feet a year to service at some future point. The Santa Barbara County Flood Control and Water Conservation District was another entity in our area that was a contractor with the state for state water. And so in the early 90s, the Santa Barbara came forward and said, okay, we're at a point now where we need to take this state water to meet our needs. San Luis Obispo County, are you ready as well? And so we basically queried the agencies within the county to see if they wanted an allocation of state water from our overall allocation of 25,830 acre feet a year. And at the time, the county board decided to contract for a capacity for that amount, 4,830 acre feet a year. So when the coastal branch was built from the Devil's Den area, the capacity for the San Luis Obispo County users was only 4,830 acre feet a year. And that's also our treated capacity, contract capacity as well. Another thing to know is that the state can't always deliver 100% of the allocations that all of the state water contractors have. For example, this year we're at 40% when you take into account the hydrology of the last years, as well as some new pumping restrictions in the Delta. However, since we only contracted for 4,830 acre feet a year locally, the district has an excess allocation that those entities that subcontract with the district for state water have entered into what we call drought buffer agreements for. And so they analyze the reliability needs, how much state water they need to get on a year-to-year basis, and have done an additional agreement with the district for a quantity of insurance water, if you will. It's called our drought buffer program. And right now, those total up to about 3,600 acre-feet a year. I should mention that Pismo Beach also recently requested a drought buffer agreement, so they're going to also enter into one. And so after you account for the water service amounts to each subcontractor in our county and their drought buffer agreements, we have still have an excess allocation of around 16,500 acre-feet a year. So who are the subcontractors in our county that take a portion of the county's allocation? We have two turnouts. We have the Chorro Valley turnout, and you can see the users on that branch are City of Morro Bay, California Men's Colony, some county facilities, and Cuesta College. And then it continues down to our what we call our Lopez turnout, and the contractors on that turnout are the City of Pismo Beach, as well as your agency, San Miguelito Mutual Water Company, Avila Beach, Avila Valley, and the school out in the Avila Valley area. Shandon also has an allocation, but at the time the coastal branch was built, they decided not to go forward with utilizing state water at that time, and so they don't have a turnout at this time to take their 100 acre-feet a year. So how does the drought buffer program work? I put up an example here of an agency over 750 acre-feet a year. But one thing to note is that the percent allocation and the drought buffer that whatever the state can deliver, that percentage gets carried through to the water service amounts for each subcontractor as well. So if the district, if the state can only deliver 50% of the allocation, both the allocation and the drought buffer for the subcontractor also gets reduced by that amount. And so in order to get 100% delivery of 750 acre-feet a year, you would need 50%, or you need 750 acre-feet a year of drought buffer. So hopefully that's not too confusing, but that's kind of the 50% example. And you, if you would want the drought buffer, you'd enter an agreement with the district, and you would pay the annual fixed cost for that quantity. And the next slide is about those costs. So if you were to sign up for a 50% reliability of drought buffer, the fixed costs for that 750 acre-feet a year is about $850. And you pay that because it's the capital cost of all the facilities to be able to take that water. And then when you actually have that water delivered, there's an additional cost of $250 an acre-foot per acre-foot delivered. So if you were to have all 750 acre-feet delivered, it's about $1,100 an acre-foot. The drought buffer costs are about $75 an acre-foot per year. And there's also a wheeling cost I wanted to mention as a state water contractor on the Lopez line. So there's wheeling through costs through the Lopez pipeline to get that state water to you. So those are kind of the different cost components. So now that's kind of my own overview of state water. I don't know if you wanted to pause here, if you had any questions on state water itself before I go into more of the management efforts that are ongoing. I think they're going to get into more detail your engineer's presentation as well.
Just very briefly, let's say the state water, for purposes of example, was cut to 30% of the original allocation. So what might be available would be your 30% allocation, and the 30% would be the maximum you could get into the drought buffer program in that scenario. Is that correct?
Right. You'd apply a 30% to your 750 acre-feet a year allocation and 30% to your 750 acre-feet a year drought buffer.
Any other questions?
I'd like you to go back to that slide and show us again. We have the fixed costs that apply to the 750 acre-feet. Mm-hmm. That's in addition to... Is this what we normally pay in addition to what we normally pay for state water, is what you're saying?
Yeah, this is what you normally pay for
this
your
state. This is my normal payment for state water is $1,100 per acre foot to get that to us. And right now we're about 40%
right
this year we don't have an El Nino, who knows what's going to happen. So essentially, this gives us a way to buy water that nobody else really in this area can buy.
The drought buffer program?
Yes, it's just the state water contractors that signed up that can participate in this program, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And those that don't have drought buffer are taking the chance that we might not have that excess allocation to provide to them in those years. So, but as I'll get into a little bit, we're starting to look at what to do permanently with our excess allocation.
Okay. Okay, and so the drought buffer costs are $75 per acre foot per year.
Right.
There's no delivery charge or wheeling charge or anything like that.
At the bottom.
Yeah, the only thing that would be new if you entered into a drought buffer agreement would be the $75 an acre foot for however much drought buffer you wanted.
Okay.
This example is a 50% reliability scenario.
Okay. Yeah. And our allocation is 703 acre foot a year, I believe. It's close to this,
yeah.
Whatever
it's
it is.
750,
is
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can I ask you to go back to the slide that had the other participants in the drought buffer or in the state program?
This
there.
One?
There we go. And how many of those are in the buffer program?
Let's see. Basically, all the Chora Valley turnout contractors. City of Pismo just sent me a letter, and so I've got to go to the board, and they'll be doing a 50% scenario. So they'll be contracting for 1,240 acre feet a year of drought buffer. And Avila Beach is the only other one that actually takes delivery of state water that has not entered into the drought buffer program.
And Shandon.
And Shandon doesn't have a turnout, so they don't currently take delivery of state water at all.
So is Pismo Beach going to be enrolling in the drought buffer program? Is that what they
right, use? Delivery year. And what I mean by 25% delivery year is when the state can only deliver that percentage of your allocation.
I have another question. Do you figure out your drought buffer every year and tell the county what you do, or you just go in and say, this is what I want total?
Yeah,
so you have to know that
automatic.
How many years does this take place? Are you signed up in a contract for a certain number of years then?
It's a more and less permanent contract.
It's a permanent contract, yeah. So you have to be pretty sure when you go in you want this much water.
Yeah, you can always increase it, but the decrease, you can't decrease it.
So you can increase it, but mm-hmm. cannot decrease.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So that's state water, and some of the, I think you'll be talking a little bit later about the condition of your groundwater basin currently, and some of the things we're looking at in order to optimize use of surface water to relieve the pressure on the groundwater is a potential opportunity to do a short-term agreement to utilize above the contracted capacity that the district has. So our contracted capacity is 4,830 acre feet a year. In order to get more delivered than that, we would have to enter in an agreement with Santa Barbara County via Central Coast Water Authority, which is the joint powers authority that operates the coastal branch on their behalf and our behalf. So we're entering into negotiations with them on this area's behalf in order to try and come up with an agreement on a short-term basis to reduce pumping in this area and take more state water. So that's a current effort. We're working with entities in the Northern Cities Management area of the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin litigation. And then on the long-term basis, we are also going to be working with CCWA to look at optimization of use of that coastal branch. There's been an initial analysis done by CCWA that suggests that there's excess capacity in the pipeline. And so having this excess allocation of water, and they're having shown that there might be excess capacity, we'd have to enter into negotiations for use of that excess capacity. Whether is the initial indication. And since, you know, the capacity, the Santa Barbara County users of state water take about 45,000 acre feet a year versus us taking only about 5,000 acre feet a year. So we can see the difference in the perceived ownership of the capacity of that pipeline. So it'll be a significant effort to work out those details. And the other effort the county is working on with agencies in your area is the seawater intrusion monitoring. I just wanted to give you a brief update on how we're over time, we've only done measurements, the level measurements in those sentry wells along the coast. And so now that they're taking regular water quality samples, we need to improve the casing and the structure of those wells. But we never had a formal transfer of ownership with DWR to the county to continue monitoring those wells. So right now we're in the process of doing that formal easement for those wells on State Parks property. And so that's kind of a process that we're continuing on and hope to have resolved soon so you can improve the casings on the wells and be more confident in the water quality samples that you're taking.
So that requires an agreement with DWR to be able to monitor and sample, more like sample the wells, is that what?
Right.
And then do they measure it or do they track it? Or what happens with the information?
I think what we're going to do is DWR is going to formally relinquish the wells to the county, and the county will have an agreement with State Parks on whose property the wells are. At least we're trying to determine. A couple of them are on the boundary of private property versus state parks, so kind of a detail we're trying to work out through surveys and such. And in that agreement with State Parks to access those wells, we'd include the county and other agents and agencies that need to come in and sample the water quality. And I think the Northern Cities Management Area is going to be taking the lead on those ongoing water quality sampling events.
Just very quickly, with the quality of, well, I should say lack of quality to the access ports, the environment, would that hamper the sample at all? Because when I first originally looked at this, I thought, oh my gosh, how could you get a clean sample out of that?
In those wells, and has not done any quality measurement on the water.
In the recent past, as far as I know,
condition perhaps of potential saltwater intrusion by monitoring the levels.
I'm sorry, could you?
Are you able to deduce from the levels the potential for saltwater intrusion?
I think the levels and their level above or below seawater can help to support or not support what the quality measurements you're seeing in the basin are.
Thank you.
If they're lower and you are seeing, in addition, that quality spike, then that's a better indication of what's happening.
Corroborating data.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was kind of a summary of what the county is working on in cooperation with your area, and I just wanted to acknowledge the efforts that you're doing here locally through conservation and looking at recycled water options. And I think you had also previously done a desalinization study and looking at those different options for addressing your water needs. And I just wanted to make sure I understood that, and I think they'll get into more detail in their presentation because we're going to be wrapping up those efforts in a countywide master water plan. So not only the issues here, but also throughout the county in terms of looking at the supply and demand now and into the future, and if there's any deficiencies in supply versus demand, and looking at what are the water resources strategies, management strategies that can be employed to help address those needs. And some of them we've already touched on in terms of optimizing the use of state water and really focusing on ways to make more effective and efficient use of our existing supplies before looking to other options. And within the master water plan, since it is countywide, we did break it down into what we called water planning areas. And so Oceano would be a part of our Northern Cities Planning Area. We are actually in the process of redefining how we're going to talk about the water planning, and we want to make it sure it correlates with the outcomes of the litigation in the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin, so it will be consistent with those. But just noting the supply sources of state water, Lopez water in the basin itself, identifying the different users, both urban and agriculture and overlying uses, and resources to come together to develop our region and cooperate on looking at not only water supply issues, but water quality and flood control and ecosystems in order to make sure we're looking at water resources holistically and ensuring that we manage our supplies to meet those multiple benefits and meet those address those multiple needs in those areas. So the county took the lead on developing an IRWM plan. We defined our region as the county. And we recently had the state recently accepted our county as the region. And so we can keep moving forward in the IRWM program process. Our latest plan was developed in 2007. In it, one of our high priority projects was the Zone 11A Waterway Management Program, which is a very near and dear to your heart, I'm sure. And in the 2010 plan, they're going to release new guidelines for doing RWM plans. And so I would like to make sure I incorporate the Northern Cities Management Area and Oceana CSD's new efforts in terms of water resource management. And so as we go through that process, mainly through the Water Resources Advisory Committee, most of our technical meetings on the development of those plans are done at the Water Resource Advisory Committee meetings. So we'll be seeking feedbacks from all the agencies that participate to make sure our plan is adequate. And the reason it's good to be in an IRWM plan, have your projects and programs in them, is that it makes you eligible for grants that are indirectly or directly related to the IRWM program. Prop 84, there's a chapter in there where it's specific to the IRWM program, projects that promote integrated benefits for groundwater and flood control and water quality and supply get the best credit for those grant opportunities. But then there's also other chapters that say must be consistent with the IRWM plan. And so sometimes the grant criteria requires that you be in an IRWM plan. So it's kind of the benefit of being acknowledged in that plan. So hopefully down the line we'll be competitive for those grant opportunities that come up for IRWM planning.
So I have a question. What are the kinds of projects you're looking at right now for this next grant program? We are not signatories at this time then. Is that correct?
No.
Not signatories. Who attends
we've had some turnover, but Kevin Walsh was coming. So,
okay. Well, we know who will be coming now. Yeah. We think our new general manager will be coming. Raphael will.
That'd be great.
Okay. And I know that Zone 11A really has a lot of things that we could maybe piggyback on, I'm hoping. That we can work together on something like that.
Yeah, I think we have it represented in the plan as a comprehensive program, so it's got all the components of the whole waterway management program in it. So any component of that would be eligible.
And which really means Arroyo Grande Creek, which really means all the way up to Lopez Dam, which really means Zone 3. And if we put all of those together, we would probably have maybe we could figure out something. We have a lot of things to figure out, let's say.
Yeah, definitely the more integrated the benefits of the projects, if they address quality and supply and flood control, then the more competitive they are, definitely. And even interagency cooperation that also makes a better project for eligibility purposes.
Yeah, I would think if we were using the whole creek watershed and all the cities along the creek watershed that are participating or next to it would maybe benefit to a great extent. That's, I don't know, a huge amount of watershed that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
well, I kind of got into this, but we are looking for support and input on these countywide master water planning efforts and the integrated regional water management plan. We post our materials on slocountywater.org, so I invite you to explore that website. It's got a lot of information on it. Hopefully it's helpful, and always looking for feedback. Make sure we're characterizing your issues accurately and appropriately. So we want to make sure we understand that. It can convey that to the Board of Supervisors through these documents as well, if there's ways that they can support your efforts and needs. And that's the extent of my presentation. This is a map of the coastal branch of the State Water Project, if you're interested in seeing the different facilities along the way. But to be taking measurements even on a greater basis, because ours is only twice a year, so I'm not sure as they proceed with their management efforts if they would want to implement more frequent measurements. But we would continue on with our measurement program.
Okay. Vern, any questions?
No, I'm very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the report. Item number 8C is a review of construction progress on the sewer rehabilitation project from the Wallace Group. Pardon me?
Any questions from the public on the last item?
Yeah, well, are there public comments? I'm sorry, are there public comments on the report? Please come up to the microphone.
Nina Grabiel, Oceano. On those figures that were given, how does that relate to AB 32, any of the fees that are going to be incurred through AB 32? Or is that part of those numbers or not? Or
I'm not familiar with AB 32.
The Air Resources Board, they're going to be, I know I've read that. And I read the draft, and in that draft, they have a carbon tax on water that they want to implement statewide.
Those figures didn't include anything regarding AB 32.
Okay. And then state water that we get from the state, well, that's something you guys might want to look into. I don't know if that part of that resolution passed or not, but that's something that I think everybody needs to look at, particularly since there is no carbon in water. I don't understand what the state's doing there. But also, when we get, if there, the state water that we receive, is that have fluoride in it?
Yeah, I'd have to.
I know the state puts fluoride in their water.
I'm not sure on the treatment process at Colonial Pass. I'd have to get back to you on that. I'd have to ask Central Coast Water Authority.
Yeah, because I think this district has opted out of fluoride.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe they do fluoride at the Colonial Pass treatment plant, but I'll double check.
Right. Well, I think it's something the county should look into because fluoride is known to lower people's IQ, just accepting fluoride carte blanche. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd like that information also.
Okay.
There's the fluoride in the water.
Okay. Again, thank you. This evening we have John Wallace and Steve Tanaka from the Wallace Group for, I guess, our item. I don't know if you want to address the water supply update, kind of to follow on, if you want to do that first or want to do the sewer repair upgrade first.
I think the sewer repair upgrade is pretty cut and dried.
Okay.
Good news, the county finally received the executed agreements from the state.
Excellent.
And the county has executed them and sent them back up, from what I understand. And so when we receive those, we'll be able to release the last three projects to Baker Construction for construction. I believe it's about a couple hundred thousand dollars that we'll be getting from those funds. So that's really good news. And they have extended the deadline, as I understand it, from the end of the year to the end of March of next year. So we're in good shape, both time-wise for construction as well as receiving those funds. So I think that you'll see some more construction activity out there in the near future. So that's good news.
Good.
I will change the slides here to the next presentation.
Okay.
Thank you, members of the board. Tonight, I've been asked to come back to kind of add on to our presentation that we talked about on October 14th to bring you up to a little bit more of the current information concerning the Northern Cities groundwater basin and what's happening with the basin. Some of the slides here will be a little repetitive of what you saw on the 14th, but I think it's good reinforcement. Repeat again our water supply. As you remember, we have an allocation from the gentleman's agreement with our surrounding agencies of 900 acre feet. We've subscribed to 303 acre feet from Lopez. State water, we have 750 acre feet for a total of 1,953 total available supply to us. Now, the state water, as you know, depends upon what's happening during a drought year and other environmental restrictions. So when looking at your draft master plan, the future demand at build out was projected to be 1,419 acre feet. With your existing demand right now of about 900 acre feet, you can see you have a buffer of 534 acre feet, but that's not real considering some of the limitations with the state water project. So the full allocations from the state water in particular depend upon drought cycles, what's happening, environmental factors with the judgment that was came down regarding the Delta smelt for getting water through the Delta, and then the reliability. As you know, right now we've been limited to 40% of our state water allocation, considering the snowpack that was in the Sierras and the ability of the project to deliver the water. So we are limited to about 300 acre feet. So our adjusted supply is 1,503, with our future demand of 1,419. You can see that we only have a buffer of 84 acre feet. So obviously we'll be talking more about entering into the drought buffer program to ensure the reliability of our state water project. So the recommendations from the draft water master plan were to look at the drought buffer from state water, continue our conservation efforts, reduce our unaccounted for water, which is line losses and things like that in our old water lines, future water recycling opportunities dealing with recycled water from the sanitation district. So when we look at our summary of where we've gone this last year in 2008, we used 377 in state water, 278 in Lopez, groundwater 247. So we had a total of about 902 acre feet of water, and 73% of that was from Lopez and state water, which we qualify as surface water. 27% of that was from groundwater. What's the cost of water supplies? Courtney went over that a bit when we looked at the state water cost of about $1,100 per acre foot. That includes the wheeling cost. If we look at the state water drought buffer
cost, now do I presume that let's say we're in a 50% year again, mm-hmm. and we're going to pay the full amount of our state water because it's take or pay. So that presumes that we're paying the full amount of wheeling there, or do we have to pay additional wheeling for the percentage of drought buffer water?
If you remember from Courtney's slide, you have a fixed cost for state water of about $900, $850. And then when you add the $250 on top of that for the variable cost, and you also have the Lopez wheeling cost of about $25 an acre foot, you come up with $1,100 total for delivered water.
And then It's additionally $75 an acre foot for drought buffer water.
If you were going to subscribe to drought buffer, obviously you did not do that in 2008, so that's not figured into that that figure there.
Right. And what about wheeling for drought buffer water?
Wheeling would be at the same, anytime you put water through the pipe, be it drought buffer or allocation water, you would pay the wheeling cost of the $25.
Okay, so the real cost of drought buffer water is $100 an acre foot.
Correct.
Okay. That was my bottom line question.
Is that right?
Well, the variable cost of which the wheeling.
The variable cost of which the wheeling cost is a part of is on a per acre foot delivered basis. So that's the part on, in addition to your fixed costs of which the drought buffer is a part of. So I kind of split it into fixed costs that you pay no matter what you get delivered, and that would be the $850 for your 750 acre feet a year, and then $75 an acre foot for any amount of drought buffer you want. So that you'd pay no matter what you got delivered. And then the quantity of that 750 acre feet a year that you get delivered is what's the variable cost is applied to. And so a component of that variable cost is the wheeling charge per acre foot delivered.
So we only pay...
What's that?
Oh, sorry.
No. It's...
So we only pay for wheeling costs when we have it delivered here. We
right.
pay for the total fixed costs totally for the 750.
Upon your demand and whether water conservation has cut your demand, there's no sense in taking more water than you can actually use. So you may contract, like Morro Bay, they've contracted for double their allocation.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not use that in any one year because of the circumstances of their demand and what the state's actually delivering under their normal contract, but it's an insurance policy.
So we can decrease the amount. We can say we want the full allocation, but we can decrease the amount during the year?
No. We can decrease the amount that we want delivered, but we have to pay the total fixed cost no matter what,
mm-hmm.
but we would pay less wheeling costs because we had less actual water delivered. You have to run through mm-hmm. some examples to
yeah.
So if you contract for 20 acre feet of drought buffer water and you actually get delivered 10, you're going to pay 20 times $75
and 10 times
and 25. Then 10 times effectively 25 for the wheeling because you're only receiving 10.
Right.
So that's how the cost breaks down on the
correct.
Okay, that's thank you for making that clear.
And that's the same for the original 750 acre feet.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, if you're taking drought buffer water, you're not getting your full entitlement of the 700 right. acre feet, so you're paying the fixed cost for 750 and the wheeling cost at $25 for what you actually take out of that 750, what you actually get delivered as a part of that 750. Mm-hmm. We need the whiteboard here and some examples to go through.
We have a whiteboard up there that maybe we could set up some examples so people can see. But it is definitely a cheaper way to go for those of us that have contracted for state water, especially when something like seawater intrusion is looming at our doorstep here.
Well, I'll add another factor there is that you pay the $75 for your drought buffer and your $25 for wheeling, but you're paying $250 to $300 to pump water out of the ground, so you actually have a little savings there. So I think we need to we'll run through some examples for you and send those back to Raphael, and then we can take a look at them and discuss them in more detail. You have to do the math and go all the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do we have to draw down in any particular buffer program? Could we draw down on that first, then go to our state water, and then go to, say, a couple months of groundwater, and then last but not least, the Lopez water? Can you do that?
Well, it wouldn't make economic sense to do that because you're paying for your full cost of your state water no matter what.
Right.
And you're paying your full cost of your Lopez water no matter what.
Okay.
So
that answers one question.
You want to draw down those because right. You are taking those, you have to subscribe to the full amount and pay for the full amount.
Yeah, you have to pay for it no matter what.
Right.
So, not to bring up a sore subject, but do we have the capability of bringing in all the water that we have paid for into the area?
I'm really glad you asked because they've been doing, Phil and the city of Arroyo Grande have been doing some flow testing on what we call the Briscoe turnout, which is where the Lopez line turns out to come towards Oceano, right there where Briscoe meets the freeway, essentially. And they have taken a valve out of the pipeline that was restricting some of the flow, and they have flow tested it today, and it looks really good. It looks like even more than what Phil and I talked about earlier this afternoon. I got a call from the city of Arroyo Grande just as I was leaving, and it looks like that we can get probably, cross our fingers, our full entitlement through the pipeline now.
And we've never been able to get our full entitlement, have we?
For two reasons. There was material that had built up in the pipeline over the years, which was then cleaned out with what they call a pigging operation. It was pigged out and increased our flow by 30% or so. And then now with the removal of that valve, we're controlling the flow with a gate valve rather than a mechanical valve that operated automatically. And it looks like that we may be able to get our full flow through that pipeline now.
Happy days, Eric.
Yeah, so we'll come back with more detail on it because the information is brand new this afternoon, and we want to make sure about it. But it looks good.
Okay, can you really keep us posted on that?
You bet. And
thank
Phil's
you.
Involved with it, too, in the testing. He's done a good job of it. Okay, Courtney's writing some information on the board. But
Okay. So pretend your allocation is actually 100 acre feet a year and that you signed up for 100 acre feet a year of drought buffer. So that 100. Say it's a 50% delivery a year from the State Water Project and you want all 100 acre feet of your allocation delivered. So what you pay for fixed costs is $850 an acre foot. So you multiply that by the 100 acre feet a year of your allocation, and that's what you pay no matter what you have delivered. And you have your drought buffer of 100 acre feet a year, and so you pay the fixed cost for that at $75 an acre foot, and so you pay the $7,500 no matter what you have delivered. So those are your fixed costs. Now you're taking delivery of 100 acre feet a year. 50 of those acre feet are on paper allocation, and 50 acre feet of those are your drought buffer. And so the variable price of that delivered water gets applied at $250 an acre foot. So essentially, 50 acre foot, that is your allocation that's available, times 250 plus your 50 acre feet of drought buffer that's available at 250 to get the full 100 acre foot delivered to you is the variable cost. Now, in that $250 is the wheeling charge for the Lopez line of $25 an acre foot. Does that make it a little clearer?
It's understandable, not necessarily simple, but it's understandable.
It's taken me 8 years to get that.
I think part of the confusion has been, where is that $25 of wheeling cost? And I think Courtney's explained it. It's in the variable cost there of the $250. So going back to my example over here, I think I probably have overestimated that a little bit because I've added another $25 in there for wheeling cost. But we'll run some examples for you using our 750 acre feet and some different examples there of what it would cost us.
Well, it looks like maybe I'm missing something, but the drought buffer water then would have $75 fixed cost per...
And you want all 180 delivered to you?
I think we better come back with some confirmed examples. And I'll have Courtney check our math, and hopefully we'll have it accurate.
Okay, I appreciate that, because it's not a simple...
It's not simple, but we need to give you some scenarios, and then we can calculate it from there. But roughly, again, it's about, we're saying approximately $900 an acre foot for all the water that was delivered. Any more questions on that? I can go into the production in the monitoring wells. Here's your production wells number 7 and 8, and I put those back up on the screen because those are the closest wells that you have to the coast. And you can see that I've listed here that the depth of the wells along with where the water level in the wells is in relation to sea level, what we call mean sea level. So you can see that well number 7 is 162 feet deep, but the water level in there is only a half a foot above sea level. And likewise, well number 8 is a deep well, and the static water level is 3.8 feet above sea level. So it gives you a relationship of where our static water level is in the wells, regardless of how deep it is. The water rises in the well, but it's very close to sea level.
Are these numbers taken after the well is set for a while, or while it's running? After it's set for a while.
After it's set for a while. You don't want to take it just after it's been pumping, because it will have drawn down.
And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but well levels or our water table levels vary depending on the time of year.
They do, depending on the time of year, and obviously depending upon how much rain we've gotten that season.
So these numbers are taken during a high time of year or low time of year?
These were taken in August, I believe. Bill, was that correct? Okay, it may be even more recent.
Yeah. First of October.
Okay, October data.
Okay, and is that during a high time or low time of year?
Low time.
Low time, okay.
Yeah, because we've been pumping as well as it's been dry. You know, we hadn't had the rain that we've just had. We also have monitoring wells, and they've been characterized different in terms of depth. Now, as we talked about, there's the sentry wells along the coast here. We have 4 sentry wells starting up here in Pismo, down here along beside the state park, the one off of Pier Avenue, and then the one down in the dunes. The wells that I just showed you in our depot parking lot are these wells here, and they're used also for monitoring purposes. They aren't production wells. Here's the depth of the sentry wells that are... the 4 wells that I showed you, plus our oceano observation wells here, and the crosshatch areas are the areas that where the well is screened or perforated, so that we're measuring the quality and the quantity of water in terms of its water level from those various depths. And so there's clusters, as you saw before in our pictures. In the monitoring wells or sentry wells, there's 3 actual wells there. Are casings that are screened at different levels, and that allows us to get water quality and water levels from different depths there. These are the numbers of those wells that are in the county nomenclature basis. We talked about the sentry wells last time. This is sentry wells. It's a cluster of 3, remember, and their numbers are NO1, 2, and 3. And Phil's clearing out a little space there. These are the ones off of Pier Avenue next to the entrance to the state park there. This is the condition of the casings. We understood that they had rehabilitated this somewhat this last year here, but you can see that they need more maintenance. In fact, some of the casings were open where surface water and debris could enter the casings. This is one of the casings with the cap on it that Phil is lifting off there. This is the second area of sentry wells going up towards Grover. And this is Highway 1. This is the State Parks Maintenance Yard over here. And Phil is lifting the cover off of this cluster of three wells there, designated as FO 1, 2, and 3. These are in a little bit better conditions, but you can see that still there is a port with no cap on it. Talking about seawater intrusion, to give you a little bit of a diagram as to what happens on this, and you can see that we have our groundwater aquifers over here. The groundwater surface is starting to come into the basin, and it slants like that because, again, it comes from the top down to the bottom, and it gradually comes into the aquifer, but the fresh water floats up on top of it. You don't see it. If the well was truncated right there, you wouldn't see seawater intrusion. You'd have to go lower to see it. But that gives you a diagram of how that works in the process. It goes pretty slow, but the problem is once it affects your wells, it's very hard to reverse. This is the chloride concentrations in the Sentry wells. And you can see that back in 1965, these wells were measured at chloride levels of 100 to 150 parts per million. And we come over here in the last part of August of 2009, and you can see what happened here in the well that's down by the Pier Avenue. The chloride levels jumped up to 500 parts per million. Still substantially below pure seawater, quite a bit, but 500 parts per million of chlorides is about the recommended limit that the state will have for drinking water purposes. So you can see very definitely that we've got an indication that we have some mixing going on there and that there's some evidence of seawater intrusion. What are our recommendations? I explained that in my report to you, but basically we recommend that we continue the groundwater monitoring required by the settlement agreement with Santa Maria. Work with the northern cities and other agencies to augment and decrease our pumping of groundwater and to purchase state water drought buffer water. Continue to explore recycled water options and investigation of a seawater intrusion barrier project, where we would like to perhaps, if we need to, inject highly treated recycled water to form a mound at the interface between the seawater and the freshwater, which will prevent the seawater from coming in because it would be a higher elevation. And then we would be back to the board with more detail and cost sharing and alternatives that we foresee here. So that's a little bit of an update on where we stand. And again, those are our recommendations. Be happy to answer any questions.
Could you go back to the diagram that shows how the seawater comes
yes,
in? And
yes,
can you show where the well would be picking up, like the salt water indicator now, how that would be picking it up?
It's picking it up as the seawater is so different than freshwater, and it is heavier as it creeps in. That interface is fairly small. That's why you see a large jump in the chlorides very quickly.
Yeah.
A seawater barrier would presumably, for example, pretend that this is an ejection well for a minute. You would form a mound of fresh water here that would be shaped something like that. And as the seawater tried to come in, it would hit that mound of fresh water and be repelled by it because it would have a higher elevation than the seawater.
It would be like a wall.
It would be like it's a barrier.
A wall of water.
It's a barrier. It's a wall of water. Mm-hmm.
But it would still come in underneath.
Well, no, you would do the injection well such that it would be through the process of test wells. You'd have to find out the exact depth and so forth. But presumably you'd come all the way up here like that to provide that barrier. This is done in other areas, primarily in our area in Southern California. There's at least four or five major barrier projects along the LA basin down there that do this exact same thing.
Okay, this groundwater basin that we have that we're in is running how far north of here and how far south? How long is this wedge of intrusion?
It's localized to this Sentry well that we're talking about here. The other Sentry wells have not shown any evidence of it. So looking at the groundwater contours that are being mapped by the consultant that's a consultant to the northern cities, it looks to appear to be kind of a trough that we see coming in at this point here. But we're worried because we have our wells number 7 and 8 pretty close to this. If you had a barrier project here, you could actually draw down your surface water actually below sea level behind it because you would have a barrier that would prevent that seawater from coming in.
Can I say on your recommendations that on one of the second ones you have the state water drought buffer, and I know these recommendations came in before you found out that our pipe can actually pump to capacity, which I don't think it's ever been able to do. So can you safely say that maybe your recommendations might change a little, that we might be able to pump what we already have paid for? Because Oceano has paid a lot of money for our water, and we've been, it hit much harder than other little communities at the tunnel.
Yeah.
Can you say that at this point your staff recommendations could be perceived as a draft until we see how that line's going to work? Because most people don't know that we haven't had the capacity to pump what we've bought.
Right. You're absolutely correct. I think in simplest terms, we're recommending that we pump a minimum of groundwater. You have to pump the groundwater wells periodically for sampling purposes that are required by the state. You have to pump them for maintenance purposes, and you don't want them to have a problem that way. But the idea is to pump the groundwater wells the very minimum that we can, and on our other sources, obtain the water from the various sources at the least possible cost.
Right.
And that may, we may go into drought buffer, we may depend more on Lopez, it depends upon what is happening with the state deliveries, but the idea would be to manage that combination of sources at the least possible cost to the district.
Oh, most definitely. And also in your report, when you're working with the county or who owns these wells, you know, it's more than just what we can consume down our throats. I mean, I look at the environmental area of these wells, and I immediately start thinking of all that mosquito abatement stuff that they put around there to stop the mosquitoes, and it's seeping into the wells. And I honestly don't know if I can ever drink any more water out of the tap again after just looking at these pictures. So can you include something in your report to the county or something like, this is really a public health problem to have sample wells, drinking wells, whatever you may call them, in this condition? I would never have this kind of standing water in my yard for fear of, you know, mosquito, West Nile virus and stuff. So
a couple points there.
I know it's out of your scope of work, too.
No, that's right. A couple points. These are not potable water wells or production wells. They're only sampling wells, and so there's nobody drinking water out of those wells.
The poor sampler.
But the Northern Cities group is contracting with the consultant to raise those sampling ports and to provide more safe.
Tested once that perhaps lagoon water could be used to pump into the groundwater basin as a buffer, as possibly opposed to or in conjunction with recycled water. What kind of quantity would be required of water, whether it be recycled water or from whatever source, to establish that buffer zone that you're talking about?
Nobody knows quite yet, because the extent of the barrier project could go from south of Oceano all the way up towards Pismo, or it could be localized where there are certain conditions that are conducive to the seawater intrusion. That's the subject of more studies. But in terms of the lagoon itself, I think that you would have to treat the lagoon water just as if you were treating recycled wastewater to the same degree because of the wildlife there. And if you were to pump much water out of there, I think you'd have some significant environmental considerations with the water levels in the ponds. And it's also a little bit brackish, too, from the influence from the ocean.
I had another question, because we've done desalination studies and recycled water studies and that kind of thing. And the last recycled water study we did, we didn't look at, I guess, what the quality would have to be to inject into the groundwater. So the cost would be more than we expected, or not what we really had in the study. Is that correct?
It would be the same as if it were tertiary treated water.
Okay.
So although it wasn't flagged as a particular use, it would be the same as some of the other uses identified in the study for tertiary treated water.
Like ag water or something
for
like
ag
that.
Substitution, yeah. Where it was on edible crops or for unrestricted landscaping and parks and so forth, where people have contact with it.
How much was that water per acre foot? Do you remember?
Well, again, it depends. A large portion of the cost was transmission cost, depending upon how far you take it in the pipelines that you need to build it. So it was anywhere from a couple $1,000 an acre foot on up to $5,000 an acre foot, or even more if we were to try to take it up to Lopez Dam to look for environmental releases and to substitute that for the releases that we're making out of the dam.
So if we inject the field,
we are
not doing overdrafting, and it's probably good that we have the groundwater litigation going on so that we're all in this together, so that everybody can work together on this.
At least we're monitoring more frequently.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You said that it's very likely we'll be able to get all our water, state water and Lopez water, through the pipeline that we have allotted, and that's assuming the whole 750 acre feet of state water and the 303 acre feet of Lopez.
That's what the preliminary conclusions are that just came in this afternoon, but we're going to be verifying those.
Does that now we you know there's different demands during different times of the year. Is that assuming an equal demand throughout the entire year, or is that taking into account the higher demand during the higher time of year?
No, your demand through the year varies. Oops, there we go. You can see how your demand goes through the year in different months, depending upon the summer months. So you have a higher demand, so you don't need that full amount of water going through the pipe in, say, January or February.
No, but you need to be able to get you need to get that higher amount during the summer months.
Exactly.
It looks like it's going to be able to do that.
That's, again, what we just heard this afternoon, and we've yet to verify it and see the figures and the test data, but that's what the phone call indicates.
Okay. Great.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Is there a comment or questions from the public on this report?
Put everybody to sleep.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Let's take a five-minute break, and we'll resume with the water and sewer rate study information. Okay, let's come back to order, and the next item on the agenda is number 8E, Water and Sewer Rate Study Presentation, and we have John Wallace and Steve Tanaka.
Thanks, both with Kevin Walsh and other district staff, to get the data in a format suitable to Clayton Tuckfield to then get his portion of the study going. So at this point right now, what we're doing is working with district staff to extract that data from the accounting system so that Tuckfield can then import that information electronically into his spreadsheets. So we're working on that effort right now. What we're doing right now is taking a look at some of the limitations on the data that we can actually extract from the district's accounting system. and we're looking at different means of trying to get that information from a hard copy printout then to an electronic format that's suitable for Tuckfield to import into his spreadsheets. So we will be probably coming back to you here at a later time to take a look at some options on how to get that information in a better format for Clayton Tuckfield. And that's where we're at right now on the study. And I'm here to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, do you have, is all the information been supplied by staff, or do you need additional help from staff, and then it's a matter of translating?
Yes, it's really an issue of translating the data right now. The information that we know we need is all there, and we've confirmed with Clayton Tuckfield the format that it's needed in. The difficulty that we're having right now is getting the data then to the information that he does need is very detailed, you know, by account. So there's a lot of information that he does need. That information needs to get into an electronic or a spreadsheet format. But the accounting software has limitations on being able to actually do that, to actually import it electronically. So we're in the process right now of evaluating some options for using some software programs such as OCR technology to actually scan and read that data, get it input into a format that would be suitable for Clayton Tuckfield. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now. And so it's really getting the data into a suitable format electronically for Mr. Tuckfield.
OCR recognizes dot matrix characters, huh?
Well, we've done some test runs with a software, and it looks like it's actually doing pretty well. It, you know, does, you know, for instance, like ones and L's and zeros and O's, you have to clean those types of things up. So we're trying to get an idea of what level of effort that's going to take to accomplish that. But our first trial run, at least.
Miscellaneous charges. So he's going to make recommendations on all of those. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So it'll be both on connection fees and monthly user fees for both water and sewer.
Okay, thank you.
Any timeline? Any kind of...
Yeah, well, we've got to get this data set to Clayton, and that's the critical aspect of what he needs to do. We already have essentially the five-year capital improvement programs drafted from our master plan efforts. And then from there, it's probably 2 to 3 months for Clayton to get his process completed as far as coming up with preliminary findings for rates. And then he will be coming here to the district to report on his findings.
So possibly February time frame?
Possibly,
February,
yeah.
March, allowing for holidays and so forth?
Yes.
You think all the information that he'll need, he'll have within a couple months, and then
we're hoping to try to get this data issue resolved here as quickly as possible. So hopefully within the next month.
Okay. Any questions from the board? Comment or questions from the public? Okay. Thank you very much, Steve. We have the business item associated with this is the staff recommendations that we receive and file these reports, direct staff to coordinate with the other agencies in the Northern City's groundwater basin to develop a coordinated plan to diminish groundwater pumping and facilitate the use of alternate supplies. Also to direct staff to return to the board with more detail on the cost of alternate supplies and arrangements with other purveyors to share the costs of this program. Did you have any other, Raphael, any staff input or any other?
John and I both attended, like, you know, the gentleman's agreement and stuff. And it seems that perhaps we're a little more concerned about what needs to be done right away than our neighboring villages are. But everyone is concerned, and we have another meeting set sooner than they used to set the old meetings. And John and I are both going to attend, and Phil's going to attend, and we're looking at alternatives and suggestions to what we can do as far as sharing the cost of the new things that are coming up.
Okay. Do we need any more than a sense of the board to make these recommendations to staff? concerns?
I believe not at this point. Phil and I and John are, you know, all concerned. We all have it on our calendar, and we'll see next week with when we meet with the surrounding villages what they say.
Okay, so the board then is in agreement that we're directing staff to proceed with the recommended actions to coordinate with the other agencies and return to the board with more detail on the cost of alternate supplies and arrangements.
I agree with that, yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Good, man. All right, we have provided direction. Item number 8F is review of current tracts and development projects and staff recommendations. Raphael?
Phil knows more about this than I do, but basically the things are on track as far as the developments go, and they're working on some projects. And they're listed here, the three of them. And, you know, if you have a specific question, I'm sure that Phil knows more about it than I do.
Okay. The only specific question I had is on the will serve letter. It appears for Petico Development on Railroad Avenue. Our letter states that there's a starred amount representing a deposit toward the installation of the sewer lateral, and there's no corresponding star. There's a two-star talking about the inspection fees, but I'm missing the one star. Is that on the letter?
Are you talking about the fee letter?
Yes.
On the back of the fee letter, there is a single aster.
Right, and it says this amount, referring presumably to an asterisk amount that appears somewhere else on the letter, which I am not able to find.
The installation charge, $1,500, right below the two stars on the first page is where the single one should be.
Okay. Will we be informing the applicant of that?
No, you're not installing a second sewer lateral?
Okay, I see.
Bill?
This is that commercial development that's on,
Railroad
Street. Railroad Street. We have two sewer connection fees. One is for $375 and one is for $700. And then we have two inspection fees at $50 each. And then we have an installation deposit of $1,500. Are we putting in one sewer lateral or two?
We're putting in one sewer lateral.
The sewer connection fee, that was one question I had, is where the two various connection fees come from.
One is for the apartment on top.
So that's
an $375.
Yeah, $375.
Okay.
And the 750 is for the
meters
on the bottom,
is
for a 3/4 inch water meter.
This one is a sewer connection.
Right. Yes.
But it's based on the size. Based on the 3/4 inch water meter.
It's based on the size of the meter.
So if it's a residential, just a residence, it would be a $500 charge. And that's based on a 3/4 or 5/8 or?
That's based on a
5/8 would be a 500. Okay. And then I just note on the water connection charges, they don't match with our codes. And I don't know that we have to do that right now, but it's generally the state water project charge it's called a capacity charge in the codes right now. And the Lopez project improvements are called additional connection fees, which doesn't make a lot of sense for most people, so I see why you are more descriptive. But maybe we want to put the code one in parenthesis or something, because it does
I strongly support what Pamela's saying, and I think we should use the terminology in the code and then put parentheses to be more descriptive if we want to do
that,
so.
That would be fine, yeah.
Okay.
Bill types fast. I'm sure he'll whip them out.
The other thing that I had to check on is we've been talking about private fire hydrants and public fire hydrants. This one isn't.
Just the tap for the sprinkler system, correct?
Yeah, just the tap.
Okay. Yeah. So it is a new sprinkler system that goes in for commercial, and it's a separate line for the sprinkler system. Okay.
Do you have any other questions?
I think that the commercial was the most in-depth kind of one that I had questions on. And then I don't know why this one lady had to ask for a permit for extending the wall for her bedroom, but she did. I thought that was maybe a bit much. She extended her wall 13 feet. It wasn't a bearing wall or anything.
But did you see what the county's requiring her to do to move that wall?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if these people have curbs, gutters, and sidewalks, but it's awful expensive to move a wall.
Yeah, just to move a wall. Oh, the other question I had is about streetlights in any of these locations, particularly the commercial
beach location. On River Avenue, there's a street light in the middle of the 50 East restaurant. Same goes for the Morningstar.
Okay.
This is the nearest corner, but it's nearly 200 feet between 150 and 200.
And Phil, what about the one on Beach Street?
That is the one on Beach Street.
Okay.
Did you check on Laguna? Right. Good all.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. Is the Morning Star and the Weiss is a different one, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the bedroom wall? Okay. What street's that one on?
Laguna.
Okay.
I guess I have a question on streetlight coverage. What is the kind of surrounding ambience that a streetlight gives? I mean, how far did that light come from the regular streetlights that we have? The big ones on the PG&E poles that are the old-fashioned kind, I guess, are the ones you're talking about?
The Cobra heads.
Is there a particular, say, does it go 200-foot radius or even more? Because I don't, you know.
Well, I have one on my corner. I'm one of the fortunate people in town. And there's a 20-foot setback, so 30 feet, but the street lights have no value to the front door, which is probably at very max 30 feet from the street. So if it's kitty corner, it would be at very most 40 feet, because there's a 20-foot setback from the property line, and then from the property line to the telephone pole is probably 12 to 15 feet,
so you,
10 to 15 feet.
So you couldn't walk to your door with ambient light from the street light without having a light on at your house?
No, I have a good porch light. I have to, yeah. Otherwise I'd be, you know,
yeah,
carrying a big stick.
Okay. I haven't looked at these areas to see how the street lights are affecting them. Maybe I need to go look.
And
see how that will work out, because maybe they need to put a small light or something, like out at the edge of their sidewalk or something like that, so that they have the ambient light to to get up to the houses. We've had so many people say that it's very dangerous to walk up to their sidewalks in some of these dark places. We have whole streets that are dark places with no sidewalks. So I'm beginning to really worry about streetlights being maybe so far apart. I don't want to pay this, you know, we have to pay the electricity, but maybe we can look at the special light bulbs that they're using and things like that instead of these big overheads too. Or maybe we can ask the builder or the person who's building to put those, they're like standard lights that stand up next to the sidewalk. Maybe they could do that. That would be a help. Anyway, just so people can see and not trip on the way right up to doorways.
Yeah, it's the ground very is dark. Really uneven.
It's very dark, and I just, maybe that's what we should do and not hold these back, but maybe take a check around town in the dark and see how this is going to work for us.
It's probably been a good 15 years since there was a lighting survey done at night.
It sounds like we're getting more and more dark places, in town. I know that some of the new developments, the sheriff's office is saying it's not well lighted and they don't like how it's come out, and they don't feel it's very safe for people to be walking around in some of, and these are new developments. So I think we need to do a streetlight survey. I guess we can get a list of where they all are.
Sure.
And just get out there and do it.
Director Dean, I agree with you on that, but I feel for the woman who's moving her wall by 6 feet.
I don't think that should be required of the lady who's moving the wall by 6 feet, and I just wondered why she even had to pull a permit to her wall.
And she has to put any curbs, gutters, and sidewalks in, which is going to cost her thousands and thousands of dollars more.
I don't think they'll require that because there's
It's stated right on that one.
It's a standard statement on all will cert letters, just so that they're aware that the county may require that.
Oh, because it says will be required.
Pursuant to that county ordinance. If that county ordinance requires it, then it's required. If the county ordinance does not
require
it, then it's not required.
So they go case by case. It's not a uniformed.
It goes by 25% increase in the value of your house is, I believe, what they go by.
Well, so if you add,
so maybe we can use a formula
and be scared off from doing her project because she sees the thing that says she's going to have to put in curb and sidewalk.
So maybe we could do maybe something like a formula like that. Yeah. Say, you know, instead of if it's, you know, case by case, whoever's got the squeakiest wheel, you know, on that policy ordinance. Maybe we could do the same thing, you know, 25% or...
To let them know what the requirements are, what the county requirements are, and the county is the one that has makes them do that. I think they would tell them at the permitting stage that she would have to do that. I think they would give you a heads up at the permitting stage that that would be a requirement of your project, so she probably knows she does not have to put inside curb gutters and sidewalks when she goes to the county and applies for her permit, which she has to do kind of before she gets the will serve letter. So they would let her know. I don't think this would scare her off, is what I'm saying.
Okay. I do also agree with your comment, especially it's not just the areas where we have no curb gutter and sidewalk and some, you know, dirt frontage on the street, but also some of the pavement due to lack of maintenance and so forth for years and no foreseeable upkeep on the horizon is making walking even on paved areas more treacherous sometimes.
Yeah, and you notice it when it gets very dark very early, and you notice it when kids are going to be out Halloween trick-or-treating perhaps and walking in those dark streets. And that reminds me, please watch out for the kids this Saturday.
Is there any comment from the public on these items? Carol?
My name is Carol Henson, and I live at 727 Halcyon Street. And just regarding the lighting and the residential areas, I believe that in the county codes, that there are codes regarding lighting that would be in the health and safety issues. And I understand that some of these neighborhoods were probably developed or slowly developed over time, and perhaps lighting was put in different years in different codes. But perhaps if a survey is done about the lighting, because I'm not quite sure what the ramifications would be if some incident were to happen in an unlit residential area, if anyone could come back on the district because there was not sufficient lighting for, you know, health and safety. But perhaps some kind of a plan could be developed where the neighbors or the neighborhoods that had insufficient lighting for safety reasons could come together maybe and all pitch in to you know, try to remedy that rather than the district taking it on completely, because the people that live in these neighborhoods, I'm sure, are concerned. And so I think there could be some kind of a remedy for that, some kind of a thing. I know that at one other meeting some time back, there was some discussion about a developer who had put a street light out somewhere and then got his permit to do the development. Once the development was over with, he took his lighting and put it in the development and didn't leave it out where it was, so it created some problem. And in the future, I would suggest that, you know, that any fees that had to do with lighting getting to an area or coming from it would be, you know, the burden of the developer.
That's,
you
know, what we'd like to see.
I was surprised that something wasn't done to make him, you know, either have to put that back or, you know, something. But of course, if it wasn't in the contract, it would be difficult to do that. And so anyway, I did want to say that there in the codes, there are specific, they call it so many candlelit feet. Mm-hmm. And you will find those in the health and the safety codes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so, so maybe we can put that item on the agenda for discussion. First of all, we need to get the list for the survey of the lights, and then maybe put it on for discussion at the next meeting.
Would you like it on the next meeting's agenda?
I think so. Okay. I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle.
Nina?
Nina Grabiello Sciano. I want to second what Carol just mentioned about residents getting together and pooling their resources to do what they want to do, whether it's lighting or repaving their street or whatever, because quite frankly, I think it's gotten to the point where the citizenry can no longer trust their agencies or their representatives to do the right thing. I see in a lot of waste and fraud in all levels of government. And it's getting to the point where we're just going to have to just start taking away, or I should say, we need to get back to the point of reclaiming our own authority. So I'm just putting this out there for the benefit of the viewing audience, that people need to, I know people in communities and other areas where people get together and they pave their streets and they put in their own lighting and so forth, and I think we need to get back to doing that because there's just too much fraud and waste in government nowadays.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment? Okay. Hearing none, do we have a recommendation?
So I'm asking that staff include this street lighting survey and a discussion at our next regularly scheduled meeting.
Okay.
If that's okay with everybody else. You know.
Certainly. Do we have any other comment on the letters? Do they look? I think we want to move those forward.
I think we can move the letters forward with the corrections that we asked for.
Agreed? Okay, then we'll move on to item number 8G, which is first reading update of ordinance fees for new water meters and sewer connections. Mary, would you start by summarizing the Water and Sewer Committee proceeding?
The Water and Sewer Committee met
Jim Hill and myself chair that. We met once. We came up with these recommendations for modification to the ordinance. We were looking at areas where the fees had not been increased in 20-plus years, and not to overwhelm everybody. So we basically just took two at this point and looked at what it costs to have a meter installed in a new development. The fee hadn't been raised in installation of meters for over 25 years. Now, if we had really brought it up to cost, nobody would be able to afford a meter, and that'd be problematic. So we recommended that it go from $675. Mr. Hill, help me here with the numbers on the ordinance. $675 to $1,650. Oh, yes.
Pardon, Director Lucy. The $1,650 was presently what's on the books, and it's been there over 20 years, is $500 for a sewer connection fee.
Oh, right. So and one was for water and one was for
exactly.
sewer.
So the $500 figure was presently on the books for the sewer connection fee, and the committees suggested that we also put it in parents that besides the fee, it would include the inspection. So that was should go to $1,650, which is basically increasing right. the sewer connection fee from $500 right. to $1,500 and taking the $50 inspection fee. We can't even get a person out there for $50 and making that $150.
Right.
So that the sewer connection fee should be $1,650, and that will include the inspection fee.
Right. I just got my projects
That's
mixed
okay.
up. I apologize. But thank you for clarifying that. And when I get done, you'll read the ordinances, the first reading.
I believe
of the
our legal counsel is going to read the ordinance, but
okay,
I'll read
whoever
it if that's
does
your pleasure.
It.
No problem.
So we looked at, we didn't want to overwhelm people, so we just picked one from the water, one from the sewer, looking at 20 plus years where there hadn't been any increases. And those were two that stood out, you know, that was pointed out by Phil, you know, two areas that might be looked at. We did it all in one meeting to save the district more time. And so we came up with an ordinance extension or modification. Would it be considered a modification?
No, it'd be considered an ordinance modifying previous ordinances, but it's an ordinance itself.
So it's an ordinance in itself. It's not modifying the existing old dated ordinance.
It is, but you're doing it through an ordinance. So.
Okay. Another thing we looked at very, very closely was language and interchanging languages and calling one thing many different names and stuff. So I think that, I don't know if that was caught in the new ordinance change or not, but it's certainly going to be caught in the policies and be more consistent on some of our verbiage, and Mr. Hill might want to extend further on that.
The sewer fees, I think we recommended would be, the new fee would be $1,500, including the inspection fee that we presently charge as a separate item. And these fees, 5/8 by 3/4 meter would be a $2,025 installation charge. The 3/4 inch meter would be $2,850 installation charge. 1 inch meter would be $4,050. 1.5 inch meter would be $8,100. 2 inch meter $16,200. 3 inch meter $32,400. 4 inch meter $56,700. A 6 inch water meter $129,600. So those would be the proposed charges. We heard there's two ways, I guess, that we could approach this. We heard from John Wallace this evening that the water and sewer rate study will be considering all of the various incidental charges that we make, not just the rates that are charged for commodity water. So there's a couple things we might consider. One is, do we do it ourselves, come up with our own numbers, or do we pay the consultant to do it, and possibly we can if the consultant is not going to have to look at that, if we do it ourselves, it might save additional money for the district. But our proposal would be that in the interest of proceeding expeditiously and also taking it a bit at a time, that we've prepared a first reading of a proposed ordinance that would modify that one of the existing ordinances was 1984-1. However, we had an ordinance passed in 2006 that combined our water and sewer rates and fees into one kind of an omnibus ordinance. And I guess it would probably be that one. It's 2006-1. I believe that's correct. So it'd be a modification of that ordinance 2006-1, which supersedes all the previous ordinances. And depending on the direction the board wants to move, we could propose adopting these with a modification to the ordinance. And again, we've prepared a first reading if we want to do that.
Director Hill, can I point out some of the fees, this was done a little bit of an unorthodox way, preparing this new ordinance, because I think some of the growing pains of working with a new GM, and we haven't really gotten our system down working with each other yet, but I was given prices, or the price changes, fee changes to add, and using the ordinances where those fees were originally established, we were able to come up with some language. This would actually modify 2006-1, which kind of combined everything. One thing that 2006-1 did not have in it were, I believe, the sewer connection fees.
Sewer connection
fees. So we're actually modifying 2006-1, and we'd be modifying 1984-1 as modified by 1994-2.
Mm-hmm. Would it be probably a more easily understood thing to do to abolish those portions of 1984-1 and 1994-2 and incorporate this directly into 2006-1?
Not as it's currently written, but I think if we went back and then consolidated 1984-1 and 1994-2 into 2006-1, I think that makes a lot of sense. That would make me very, it would quite literally consolidate everything. You should know that by doing that, we're going to end up with a new ordinance that's probably about 35 pages, which is okay. In fact, like I said, I like the idea of consolidating everything, but what you have before you certainly does not entail that.
So there's another choice to be made.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Putting together that 35-page document, I think, could actually be pretty easy, and something you may not want us to do if we provided essentially the means to do it. If you have one of your clerks, or if you instructed the general manager, I think that's something that, by cutting and pasting and then having us do some amendments, it could save a lot of time and money for the district.
Board comments or questions?
Well, this is the first time we've ever seen this. It has not come back to the board. Usually what you do is go to committee and then come back to the board and talk about the things you're talking about here. Neither of us, and Barbara Mann, who is missing tonight, have not seen this. Some of the things, you know, these things have to be done. I know John Wallace is saying that Tuck Field is going to look into these. You're looking at a small segment of what the total water connection fee will be when you talk just about meter size. This is, and the other costs that are involved with this were updated in 2006-1 and before that and consolidated. So the big update was the front footage charge in 2006-1. It went up 1,000%. I'm not sure how they figured the cost of the meter installation, but the cost of the meter installation is added to the front footage charges, added to the additional connection charges, and added to the capacity charges. And the other thing you have to consider is that all new homes over 1,000 square feet will have to have sprinkler systems, which means they have to have a minimum 1-inch meter size, which is for $4,050 for an installation charge. So at this point, you're probably getting into, you're probably getting into about $15,000 for a new for a meter connection charge. And we just haven't had, I'm not sure where all these numbers are coming from, but it seems like these should all be kind of put together. The hard part for these developers, and you saw in the will serve letters, there's no definition, there's no continuity with our ordinances, and people don't know what the heck they're going to get charged. I mean, they're looking at this saying, well, I don't know how this works, and what does this mean, and what does a front footage mean? So if it looks like we've put parts of it together, when maybe we need to discuss the full parts, connection fee.
We were very sensitive to defining terms and using consistent terminology throughout, because I think the district's terminology has confused many people over the years. And perhaps, again, there's another way to look at this. If the consultant is going to recommend fees that would probably be more in line with whatever, you know, average fees, I suppose, might be in the circumstance. There was some concern expressed among board members to try to update some of our fees that had not been raised in more than 20 years and are very much lower than any other jurisdiction, and in fact don't cover our cost of of actually doing business, again, to try to make the persons putting in new development to pay the proportionate cost and not have that burden our existing ratepayers. So, again, there's a different way to do it. Your point that President Mann is not here tonight is well taken. It's probably not appropriate to consider an ordinance absent one of our members, so we may want to postpone this for a couple of weeks.
And I don't think it hurts to talk about this or to talk about the idea behind the policy. So if you're saying, okay, we want the developers to pay a good proportion of this and kind of save the cost to the ratepayers. There's a lot of fees that have been passed on to the ratepayers, and we know a lot about what's been happening, and we don't want to see that happening anymore, which is why we're reviewing the developments and the fee letters as they come out, and we can discuss those and talk about those. So I don't think it hurts to talk about how we want to proceed and what the effect is. Do we want to put more onus on the developer and make them charge, make them pay a little extra, or how we want to go about doing this, or is it just the cost? On some of these, we're talking about fees that should have gone in restricted reserves and have not for years. And I've been told that 1994, the board at that time decided that they had enough restricted reserves and didn't want to put anything more in there. And so here we are. Eating into our restricted reserves and not being very, this is not being proactive for our community to let something like that ever happen again. So I think there's a lot to discuss, and I'd like to see it come back when Barbara is here and when we have a chance to digest a little bit more. And if you can tell us how you came up with the meter fees, what the, if it was by inflation or by the cost to install.
I think that had been relatively regurgitated several times in your ad hoc meeting. Gina and Phil both attended, and Raphael both attended all three of your ad hoc meetings. And I know that Phil repeated, you know, what had been discussed in water and sewer ad nauseum the next night as to the fees and how we had come up with those things. So Barbara Mann has been briefed till you can't brief her anymore. And that's why I really thought it was a bad idea to have, you know, to continue this divisive splitting the board, where you have two board members who are on water and sewer, and the other two board members create their own ad hoc committee to really discuss the same thing that we're all trying to get to. You know, so, you know, it is counterproductive, you know, not to have all the brains at the table and not knowing, you know, just going by third hand, you know, what the ad hoc committee is doing, and you going by, you know, second hand on what water and sewer is doing the night before.
Who briefed Barbara?
I've briefed Barbara. Mr. Hills briefed Barbara. Barbara commented on the reading of the ordinance on the agenda. I'm sure the GM talked to her at length regarding the ordinances being read on the agenda. You know, so you can ask Barbara.
Okay. What?
I was just going to add just a little information in regard to, I was at this Water and Sewer Committee, and I felt that the Water and Sewer Committee looked very well at items that, for example, have been on the books since 84, because like the 2006 one, which was the latest amendment, was the $4,080 minimum front footage fee, and that wasn't touched. So if we go to these archives, we can see exactly as listed on our suggestion for the first reading today, it's on the books. 5/8-inch meter cost $675 in those days. A 3/4-inch meter, I believe, you know, was $900. Now, I don't have the stuff in front of me, and if it's the board's pleasure, I can, you know, dig up the ordinance and show the old numbers. But so I thought that it was the committee's intent to take two items that hadn't been dealt with in years and bring them forward for a first reading, because it's only the first reading, and then we can talk about it again next time, so that by the end of the year we would qualify, hopefully, to have some type of increase starting for the new year. As far as the president, I assure you that she knows about this, because when we went through the agenda in my office, she sat down and she says, you know, what's this first reading? And I says, Director Lucy asked me to put it on the agenda, and it's in regard to two items that have just been on the books forever. You know, a sewer connection fee, $500. It costs more than that to get the people in the truck and get them out on the job. And I says, so if you don't have a problem, we'll put it on the agenda. If you do have a problem, I won't. And she says, well, I'm not going to be here. She says, ask Vice President Hill. If he wants it on the agenda, we'll put it on the agenda. And that's exactly how it ended up on the agenda this evening. As a matter of fact, then when we met with Director Hill for another situation, we asked him if he wanted it on the agenda, and his answer was yes. And that's how it ends up before you today. So I hope I've shed some information that you find helpful. Thank you.
Can I just add something? In listening to the conversation, there are, what I put in front of you has to change. Like I said, I didn't get a whole lot of information on this. I think what would be nice is to either talk to Raphael or get some kind of report from him or the Water and Sewer Committee as to kind of the findings behind this, because I had to make some assumptions putting together this ordinance, and some of those assumptions were wrong. I can just tell you in the recitals. So we can do a first reading. I mean, nothing hurts doing a first reading tonight, but I can tell you that I'm strongly going to encourage that this be changed. So the first reading is going to kind of be moot, because we're going to have another first reading if anything gets changed. So I don't know if there are some written findings from the Water and Sewer Committee that you could forward either to the general manager or to myself, maybe, that we could talk about and get a real coherent ordinance here to amend these fees.
Okay. So if I understand what you're saying, we'd need a second reading anyway, or a second first reading, which kind of makes this one not...
If there are any changes, and you have to do another first reading.
Which there has to be changes. So.
Yeah.
At that point, then, we'll consider this a report out of the Water and Sewer Committee for what was discussed at that meeting in part.
So where did these numbers come from, these amounts per meter?
From the Director of Water and Sewer, Phil Davis.
Phil, you came up with these numbers per meter?
I said they hadn't been raised in quite a few years. But
you didn't come up with these actual dollar figures?
No.
Who came up with these actual dollar figures?
It was a combined effort of the committee members and the general manager.
And Phil told us how much it cost to put a water meter in, about $675 total. That's, you know, and that doesn't cover equipment, piping, staffing. A small percentage of it goes to the actual meter, which the meter's more than that now. So I would go back to what Director Hill said and use this as this water and sewer report. If you have any valuable input, we certainly would, you know, have people put their suggestions and stuff in. And I would like to see the ordinance done in-house by board with, you know, a little bit of support from staff, but mainly as a board activity. And do it, because it should be all together. Didn't we just go through this really, really expensive codification? And so we should be able to cut and paste a lot of that codification. It was like almost $60,000 there we spent on that. So we should be able to spend some time on it and put it together, and then do a formal reading, and maybe the other directors will have some input.
Well, I mean, you can't just go and arbitrarily pull a number out of your hat or something and try.
We'll discuss it. This is a report.
Well, we have an ordinance that came to us. It was supposed to be an ordinance to be read tonight with exact amounts. It's not a report.
And it's been modified.
Okay.
It's the record as a report under the advice of the attorney.
Okay. But it was an ordinance that came through. So we can't do it because, I mean, first of all, even as a report, these numbers... You have to, if you're going to charge something, you have to be able to justify the numbers you're charging, and there's no justification here. There's been nothing done to, you know, to look at the financially what it costs for these things, and you have to justify your report. And then, you know, your numbers that you're going to charge people, it's not like a store and you sit there and make it up. And another thing is these...
You, kind of like the flat
you're right.
Feet.
There were decisions to be made here. You know, do we do this on our own here, or do we go through the rate study that's being done? And that's a decision not for a committee to make. That's a decision for the board to make. And so now we have this, because this board, this committee went and made this decision, this board decision on their own. We've got all this time and effort that the attorneys put in it that is wasted, costing the district. And because you're not following procedures. This is not, this thing is not run, no, I have a board right now, so please don't interrupt me.
I'd ask the attorney for clarification.
So
let Fern finish, please.
So anyway, the you know, when you come in, when you're going to look at this stuff, board decisions got to come back to the board to be made. It's not, you know, I mean, the board didn't direct an ordinance to be put together. It's just a committee direction. Okay? And that's not proper procedure. You know, it's you come back, you make a report, and then the board decides where to go from there. You know, yeah, these need to be raised, but how are we going to go about doing it? And what numbers are we going to use? You know, the numbers have to be justified. They've got to come up with, and it's not the directors that come up with these numbers. You know, you go back to who does the work to figure out what it costs, and they come back and suggest those numbers, whether it's Tuck Field or whether it's our own internal staff. And then that's, and of course, who does that is a decision of the board as a whole. So this was, you know, I mean, this was a lot of waste of money here.
How much waste of money, Vern? Or are you just pulling those numbers out
well,
of the air?
Well, I don't know.
How much money was that,
well,
Vern?
I will let you know, Director Dahl. Just based on the process that we went through doing this, this quite literally isn't going to cost the district any money for putting this together. So I don't want you to worry about the cost for this.
All right.
And good. It's cost much less than the ad hoc has paid themselves.
Okay, be that as it may, let's table this item, and we'll I would encourage board discussion about how we want to derive our fees in the future, whether we want a consultant, Mr. Tuckfield, to be paid to do that, or whether we want to have directors acting in concert with our professional staff do that. So that's something that we should be thinking about going forward. Public comment, please. Nina?
Nina Grabiel, Oceano. Vern, I got to tell you, this is the first time since I've known you that I actually agree with you. Any kind of numbers that people come up with for fees, I think the public needs has the demand to know how those fees are derived, because I can tell you, you know, we're not talking about just $2,500 for a connection fee. You tack that on to all the fees from the county, and I'm going to tell you, just to start a project costs what? What in this county? Probably close to maybe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 nowadays. So, you know, I think it's time that people find out exactly how are all these agencies that are supposedly charging me this money split for my benefit coming up with these numbers.
Yeah, there's been no.
I'm not paying fees to pay for somebody's vacation.
That isn't accurate, Ryan.
But I just think we need to have a breakdown of how all these numbers are derived at to make sure that there isn't any. Excessive charges being placed and burdening the people.
Thank you very much.
And the committee did take that into serious consideration. Although Mr. Dahl wasn't there, the numbers weren't just pulled out of the sky. You know, there was a baseline. And of course, you know, we'll write it down, you know. And so, but it was a jumping off point. And really the jumping off point was 20 years. You know, and we did have the director of water and sewer in the meeting with the GM. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, Mr. Hill and I sitting down and saying, okay, how are we going to get a bunch of money from the people? It simply wasn't like that. So, but I do hear what you're saying, you know, and I'd be happy to take it back and write it up as minutes or however, and if the directors want to spend $10,000 paying somebody to cut and paste, then so be it.
To correct Director Dahl's comment, the meeting of the Water and Sewer Committee was properly noticed and agendized with that subject on the agenda, and it was published at least 3 days prior to the meeting. so that the public could attend if they desired, as opposed to some committee meetings, which I see are only posted the day before.
So this this was posted as coming up with an ordinance to increase water charges or to look at them. Well, how was the posting?
I have it here if you'd like to read it.
I would like to read it. Let's read it, actually.
It was posted on the window. You're
not where, how, what was said. Okay, so consider district policy to calculate upfront footage fees.
Director Hill, I think that we brought our report back for, we've gotten advice from the rest of the board. So I would ask that this has been tabled. There's going to be a report written, you know, and be brought back to the full board. I'd ask you move the agenda.
We will move on to administrative items, status report on the 2007-2008 audit, the report from the general manager and board liaison. Raphael, would you like to start?
I'll start. My report is I received an email this morning from our auditor. I called last week and asked for an update. And we played phone tag and email tag. And this morning, I actually received an email showing the items that he says that he is still missing to complete the audit. And I responded to his email telling him, you know, thank you for his time for identifying to me the items that he needs. And I responded that we would put them together and that I would deliver them to his office. Now, that's not the report that I would like to make. I would like to say that it's in better situation, but that wouldn't be accurate, whereas the report that I just made is accurate right to the last hour. He has highlighted, I have them on my desk. We're going to put them together, and I'm going to bring them to his office.
Excuse me. I did copy it, my memo to you, but I did send him this one item that he asked for. He called me and told me that it satisfied what he needed.
Well, that's good. That means that the list that's presently on my desk is shorter, and that's what we're trying to do, make the list as short as possible. And I even offered to hand deliver them because we need to move this audit off the dime. It needs to go forward.
I also contacted the auditor. This certainly does need to go forward. We have a long history on this about how the audit was supposed to happen. And it's been reported to us that all of the information that the auditor asked for had been delivered to the auditor. And then it turned out that that wasn't accurate. So then we had another transmission of all of the information to the auditor, and then it turns out that that wasn't accurate. So today we had apparently another transmission of information to the auditor, and the auditor's statement to me in an email yesterday was that, as he told our staff on October 19th, or actually goes back to September, he will not be able to complete the audit until he has two items from the expense journal, and those were items EXAC 81 and EXAC 82. So what was transmitted, I don't know what was transmitted today. I have emailed the auditor on it, but it looks like we sent some other summary of information with some different file numbers. And I hope that that was acceptable to the auditor, but as of noon today was the last I heard of him, and that information had not been transmitted yet. I've learned to take reports from district staff that information is acceptable to the auditor with more than a grain of salt. So I'll leave that to the auditor, having been burned more than once by reports of completely transmitted information that turned out to be inaccurate. That is the report on the audit. Is there any public comment? Carol?
My name is Carol Henson, and I live at 727 Halcyon. I noted that at the beginning of the meeting that you had made the statement that the reserve account information had not again been provided to the members of the district. And going back to the last meeting, I know there was public comment about how much money was in the reserve account. And Mr. Hill had made the statement then that he had been trying for some time to at least get a ballpark figure of what was in the reserve account. And as I'm listening to all of this, you know, I'm hearing that the 2007 and 2008 audit is not done. It's not getting done. And I hear us talking about, the members talking about passing a new budget. And, you know, it's just general. It's so simple. You know, if you have a checkbook and you reconcile it every month or every week, and I just feel very concerned that there just seems to be this lagging and lagging and lagging, and it almost seems as if the reserve account has become this mythical account that doesn't exist. I can't understand why even a ballpark figure is not made available to Mary Lucy, Verndahl, Barbara Mann, Jim Hill, and Pamela Dean. Because when you're the fiduciaries for the whole community, and when the community members get up here and try to ask you, you know, while you're trying to get revenue and you're, talking about the budget and shortfall and all of these things, and they just want to ask a few simple questions about where these dollars are, and no one has that information, it just seems very odd, and I'm concerned. And that's all I have to say about that.
Thank you very much. I share your concern, noting that there were a number of red flags for fraud that showed up in one of the California Special District Association meeting magazines. And I went through that and looked at the auditor's reports from past years. And I noted that there were about 7 out of 9 red flags for fraud that we have right here in our operation. And you mentioned no reconciling of the checkbooks, which apparently didn't happen here for several years. And yes, I share all of your concerns and the frustration that is concomitant with. I've had so much smoke blown at me that I have to wear a lead belt or I'd float up to the ceiling. And it's very frustrating. So I would hope that staff will deliver whatever information that the accountant needs, that we will get this done timely, and we will continue to follow up as best we can.
You want to encourage development, but if the development has a portion because of we're in such debt, then people need to know.
Nina?
Nina Grabiel, Oceano. Okay, so let me get this straight. So the auditor has been asking for certain information for quite some time now, and the directors have been directing staff to provide that information to the auditor, but it has not happened. So what is the protocol for handling that type of situation where staff is not responsive to the board? Is there any methodology for accountability here?
Accountability to who?
Well, staff to the board. If the board is asking for the staff to provide information to them or to the auditor and that information is not being provided,
What happens in that scenario?
Well, nothing happens if you don't have any leadership. And at the current time, I don't feel our president is any type of leader. So what goes on will continue to go on.
So there's no written protocol anywhere in the policies?
As long as you have somebody making the decisions at a whim whenever they want to.
But don't we have policy?
The point, I think, is to take public comment on the item and not to engage in a discussion.
Well, I appreciate her responding, but I just want to know, nothing's happening as far as finding out any real information, but we're going to raise fees. We know that for sure. Is that what's going on here? No answers, but raise fees.
We are endeavoring to get the information to the auditor that the auditor needs.
Well, I think that's been going for quite a bit while, like maybe it's like over a year overdue. So I think that in light of the fact that it seems to me that this district has been put in somewhat of a jeopardy, that some heads should roll, because there has to be accountability for this type of either incompetence, gross negligence, fraud, whatever it is, something's going down here that's not right, and somebody has to pay the price. There has to be justice in the world somewhere. Please, let it be within my own local community. Let it start at home.
Thank you. Sir, other public comment?
Thank you, Nina.
Okay, hearing none. We'll move on to resolution regarding loan securitization.
Mr. Hill, can I ask you, for the sake of time, that and I only ask you this because you're chairing the meeting, but that the warrants be moved up on the agenda instead of the most important topics is our minimal resources, and that we not have it at the bottom of the agenda, and that that you allow the review of the warrants be moved up.
I will consider that. Well, right at the moment, let's do the loan securitization.
Okay, then I would ask you that you move it up to 9C.
I think we can do that.
Thank you.
Okay, loan securitization. This is approving the form of and authorizing the execution and delivery of a purchase and sale agreement and related documents with respect to the sale of the seller's Proposition 1A receivable from the state and directing and authorizing certain other actions in connection therewith. Rafael, do you have a report on that?
We have the paperwork here, and myself and the president has to sign $56 based on what our tax revenue was for last year, and that's how they're going to base it. So other than that, all I have is that we're going to make sure the deadline is November 6th, and I'm going to sign the documents this evening after the attorney's done with them, and we're going to make sure that Barbara signs them. And we'll take them to the post office and send them return receipt requested, so we'll know that they'll have our documents, and I look forward to them sharing the proceeds.
Sorry, and we should add that there is a resolution involved that has to be approved by the board. Obviously, we're short the president, but the four of you can still pass it if you so choose. It is required, and it's a prerequisite to receive these funds. Dates keep kind of changing on when everything's happening, but it looks like the pricing date on the bonds is going to be somewhere, I want to say either the 10th or the 19th of November, bonds to be sold about a week after that, and the first disbursement is predicted to be January 15th. The second one is some date in May. And I'm being literal when I say this is changing daily. But that's right now what it seems like the current firm dates are. At least I think for the bond or the pricing and the bonding, those dates will likely happen. And assuming that they find buyers for the bonds, there should be no reason why disbursements shouldn't be able to go out the couple months after that. In your packet, you will see there's a couple of things. First, there is a sample staff report that was provided by California Communities. It actually does a really good job of explaining the whole 1A securitization process and what's going to happen. And there is also a resolution in there immediately before the staff report, and that's what we are trying to approve tonight. And again, just as a reminder to the community, what this is the state has said that they're going to borrow, they're allowed to borrow up to 8% of property tax revenues, so long as they, from the communities, so long as they pay it back 3 years with interest. That puts the district and any other community in a bind for those 3 years before they get any risk whatsoever to the district. The worst case scenario is that they don't find buyers for the bonds and no one receives their 8%, and we're just going to get paid back sometime in the next 3 years. So,
and that's not to be confused with California Communities Foundation, correct?
I don't believe, I'm not familiar with California Communities Foundation. I don't believe so.
Okay.
So at any rate, the item before us to be resolved is the California Statewide Communities Development Authority Revenue Bonds, State of California Prop 1A Receivables Program Series 2009, and a resolution that we...
And the resolution will be Resolution 2009-15 from the Board of Directors of the Oceano Community Services District. It's a resolution approving the form of and authorizing the execution and delivery of a purchase and sale agreement and related documents with respect to the sale of the seller's Proposition 1A receivable from the state and directing and authorizing certain other actions in connection therewith. This is a very lengthy resolution. I would ask that we not go through reading the entire thing, but make it available to the community if they want to come in and look at it and pass it after reading of title only.
I concur with that if the board agrees. Is there public comment on this item? Carol?
Carol Henson, Halcyon. What is this loan for?
What it is this, the state has declared a financial emergency for the state and suspended Proposition 1A. Okay. So that allows the state to take, I think it's 8.5% of your property tax revenue from local communities, including the district here. So that would directly affect our fire department, which is our organization that is funded from property tax revenue. So in order to ameliorate the dramatic impact that that would have on communities, the state has come up with this Rube Goldberg financing where they're going to borrow, they're going to take the money from us, but they'll give it back to us as a loan. We sell them our interest in the property tax, and they sell bonds and so forth, and purportedly within 3 years they'll pay us back with interest.
Is so it the 8%
that is what this does? It effectively replaces that portion of the property tax revenue to the district in the interim while the 3 years is running.
It passes the risk of the district not getting that 8% back from the state to private investors not getting that 8% from the state. So,
Nina?
It's kind of hard to hear what's going on back there. So the state's going to take 8%. Okay, and we're going to get it back how?
The only reason I can understand this at all is it seems to me they're using the credit, the good credit of the district and our fellow communities, cities, and towns to issue bonds against the amount that they're borrowing from us so that they can pay it back in 3 years.
So okay, so the state is selling bonds to private individuals.
Right, but it looks like they want to use... It looks like they want to use the credit, the good credit of the... cities and towns and districts to probably make the bonds more saleable than they would be if they were state bonds at this point.
Okay, so they're going to sell the bonds, and then at the end of 3 years, we get the 8% back?
We get the 8% back this year. I'm sorry, this fiscal year. We will get the 8% back upon the sale of those bonds, and then we're out of the picture.
Yeah, we don't have to wait the 3 years to
get
our 8%.
So this is a quick turnaround.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And then they're making money off the interest or something. The state's making money off the interest. No.
The
private investor makes money.
Right.
The state's just shoving the thing into the future.
And where's the state going to get that money, that interest?
Oh, the state. It's going to come from...
Maybe I'll tell you, personally, with the state situation right now, I wouldn't involve this community in anything with the state. In fact, I would try to withdraw from the state as much as possible because California...
Just to point out,
That's what this does, and I think the state's counting on the tooth fairy to bring the money, actually. But this makes the district whole again. Other public comment? Okay, hearing none, do we have a
resolution?
A motion?
I move that we...
Resolution 2009-15. May I have a roll call, please, Gina?
Director Dean.
Yes.
Director Dahl.
Yes.
Director
Ruthie. Yes.
Vice President Hill.
Yes. Okay, recognizing the lateness of the hour, I would like to move the warrants forward on the agenda. So we will entertain the warrants at this time. Comments on the warrants.
I just have a couple generic questions. On page 2, we have, we have a check number of 49851 under United Staffing and Associates for $3,581.66. Now, is that the check number or is that the invoice number that's listed under check number?
It's the check number, not the control number, which is different from an invoice number.
So I can pull up in a couple of weeks. I can pull up using this check number, and this check will appear.
Pull up what, Mary?
The check number that's
number
shown on the warrant.
49851.
Where would you pull it at?
Let me see if I can shorten the discussion a little bit. Is I've taken quite a bit of time to generate a spreadsheet over the last year because it was unintelligible what. The check numbers, which conventionally is discussed, it's a magnetic number, a number in magnetic ink that appears on the bottom of the check. And nowhere in our warrants do you see the check number, which is the number the bank uses and the number that comes back on the bank statement. That's never referred to in any OCSD document. Instead, we have this number that appears under the guise of check number in our warrants, but in fact is not the check number because the check number is the number that just comes to the top of the page here on page 3. Well, interestingly enough, at our last meeting and meetings previous, we've done check numbers in the 051 series, and prior to that we had some numbers with 4 digits, and we've had numbers with 6 digits, and it's random all over the place, and they go forward and back and in and out, and they're not in any numerical sequence that makes any sense. And again, they don't relate to the bank check numbers, which are used in a random order and sequence and don't make any sense in how they're used either. And the bottom line of it, in my opinion, is it makes the entire thing almost impossible to audit, which is why I went to the exercise of creating the document that I did, which puts this purported district check number and the actual bank check number in order. And here's, I guess if it's my turn to comment, I'll comment thusly that in the interest of doing the district's business, and that I see that the warrants, I've looked through them, they look reasonable, that provided that we have a bill that I can look at to all of these warrants that shows these numbers, I would be prepared to approve these warrants this evening. However, this is the last time I will ever vote for a warrant summary that has a number on it purporting to be a check number that is not identical to the bank check number, which is the magnetically written clearinghouse number that appears on every check. I don't want to see any more series numbers or district numbers or file numbers, whatever else is on there. I want the same number used, and I would strongly suggest that we use those in a chronological order, such as anybody would do who manages their own household checking account. And there you have it, folks.
So
one of those red flags for fraud. We don't balance the checkbook. Yeah, takes a secret decoder ring and compass, and they don't even maintain that.
What kind of checks are we using? Usually, companies use the checks from the bank, and they have a big book and write it.
Mm-hmm. But they're not relevant. They have no value. Because let me show you, as I'm looking at a check right here, and the check number on the check will say 48880, but the check number actually is 048790.
And there's only a random correlation if you were to look at any check number vice the district's control number that appears on these warrant summaries.
Okay.
I have brought this to the attention of the auditor and the district's counsel as well, because in my judgment, this is unacceptable. That's part of the problem. So I'm currently in the process of making a secret decoder ring and compass for the year, fiscal year just ended, and I'll be giving that to the auditor so that it'll assist him with his audit of our books for last year when he gets to that, if he ever finishes the one for the year before that he's working on now.
I actually hold the leadership responsible. If we have a board president who doesn't know how to read a ledger or a check or how to figure out how much money we have in the bank, we don't have much of a leader. And which has been pointed out to me that has been self-appointed to do it again for another year. So I, too, am never going to approve any more warrants unless this changes, because it's misleading. I can't find any value in a check number in this district. I don't understand. I'm not an accountant, but I know it's wrong. I don't think it's, I don't hold one individual responsible.
So at this point, I'm prepared to improve in concept the expenditures that are recorded on the purported warrant list for this meeting.
We have public comment.
Well, for one thing is that we've got a payroll that people have worked and were required by law to pay. Public comment?
I think it speaks for itself.
Just from my, you know, I did a lot. I took care of a budget of quite a few different places for the state, and I don't understand this at all. I mean, can someone explain? Can you ask staff to explain where these check numbers come from that are printed here?
It's a good place.
Is that a reasonable request to find to under? Maybe they have something that some knowledge that the board or the public doesn't have. I think we should at least try to get an explanation to clarify what's been going on. But I don't. It seems to me that we have people who have been working in the office for a long time, and it seems odd that, first of all, that they would. That people would be working under such a system for so many years and not be held to account for how they come up with this kind of a system. I don't understand where this system even comes up with. And if these numbers mean nothing, then what is the purpose of them? And I'm noticing that there's a $400-some-odd, I guess it is, for Staples. And I imagine some of that was to purchase a safe for the office. So it's my understanding that for however long this district's been in operation, there's been no safe to secure the monies that people bring into the office. So for so many, so how many years has this been, the district's been in operation, what, 20, 30 years, 30 years maybe, close to 30 years or so? So we've had this temptation to lift money out of a drawer available to all the employees of the district. I just want the viewing public to know that. So we've got cash that's available to be lifted. We've got big time. And I think it's up to the board to ensure that that's done. I think that's part of your job as being fiduciary. You're part of your fiduciary responsibility. This needs to be investigated. And the people who oppose investigation, shame on you. You need to leave. Because you're not hired, nobody voted you to sit there and just let this type of abuse of public records and funds go on. That's not your job. Your job is not to be nice to the people who lay this district open to this type of abuse.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment? Director comments?
Yeah, I got a question. Did you... go in and ask how these...
Vern, I've had so much smoke blown up my rear end by the staff here over the years that I'm sick to death of it and tired of it. And like I said, I have to wear a lead belt to keep myself from floating up to the ceiling in here. And that's a flat-out no, Vern. I didn't do that. I took it on myself to figure out what these numbers are because you and nobody else would do it, and certainly not the staff.
I was in the office today asking the staff, you can speak to the administrative assistant and the GM, asking for some kind of explanation as to why these are immaterial to each other. You know, I've been to CPAs, I've been to banks, and I've been on the checking account for 5 days. So I'd like to know, you know, I think that, you know, by putting the warrants at the end of the meeting, not doing any cross-referencing, everybody signed, except for me, signed checks that they didn't cross-reference. I mean, I don't think they're at fault for it, you know, but did you cross-reference every check you signed with the warrants?
I checked with them.
Well, then you're blind, I'm sorry, my friend, because I found checks that you signed that were not for the amount on the warrant. I found checks that you signed only once without a second signer. There are checks that are going through with one signer. So, you know, and that doesn't, I'm not saying you're at fault for it. I'm just saying everybody has a part in it, and it's a system. So if you want to lay blame on somebody,
I don't want to lay blame
you
on
know
anybody.
What? It, the blame.
Again, I would hope that we adopt using the number that the bank is going to use on the check and not some fictitious number that's generated apparently randomly.
So,
Go ahead.
I would just like to shed a little light on this situation. Now, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, we're not making decisions based on you got telling us what's going on. We're just,
I'm just gonna
this point jumping to conclusions.
No, I'm just
saying that
share a few comments. You know, what do I know? I've only been here 3 weeks, but Director Lucy was in my office today, and she was extremely concerned about these check numbers and these warrants. And I went to great lengths to make sure I knew exactly what her concern is. So, for example, I only have one piece of information that she wants, and I'm going to share it with you. But hopefully, before we do this again, I'm going to have this same piece of information for the entire list. Now, the comment that she asked about for the United Staffing Associates, the amount for $3,581.66, okay? If you look at that as it comes around before you sign it, you'll see that the check number, as it is on the face of the check, is 49851, whereas it shouldn't be. As far as if you wanted to match it up to something, that number should be 51205. And as Director Hill said earlier, that 51205, that's the number that you'll find at the bottom of the check that the bank's going to use to clear. Now, you know, I inherited this system, and like I said, what do I know? I've been here 3 weeks. But for whatever reason, they've done it like this for over 20 years. So now that I know exactly why Director Lucy's upset, what we're going to do is we're going to better identify so that the number that you see on the sheet is going to match the number in the lower left-hand part of the check. And that'll help a person that wants to actually see what they're signing and match it up with. So, you know, I know it's just a...
Apparently because they've been doing it all along.
Will these numbers come out of the air?
I have no idea where they came from.
Well, we ask.
Very good. Very good statement.
Well, let's ask.
That's exactly what needs to happen. We need to have
it. We're asking right now.
Right. So what the staff needs to do, instead of jumping to conclusions and not knowing and making all these big statements, we need to have staff come back with a report. Why are these check numbers used? What are they?
Right now,
we're going to change the process. That's why I used that 51205 for an example, because that one was done. Okay, now they obviously all need to be done, but we can't do them overnight. And we're talking about a system. We're talking about a system that has been in place for over 20 years, but we understand the director's concerns, and we'll address it.
And in the meantime, we'll hear either if you want to come, you want to give us now a reason why it's done this way, or how it's come about this way, or if you want to do that at the next meeting. Either way, that would be more appropriate.
I would rather spend the energy on moving forward, like just that little piece of information that I gave Director Lucy today, than try to figure out why this thing has been here for over 20 years. That's not gonna solve anything. Plus, obviously, that's not the information we want. So my job is to provide you with the information you want. And like I said, I offered that the number that Director Lucy wants for that $3,581.66 expenditure is 51205. Find that check and you'll see it. And I assure you that we'll provide that information in the future.
And that will help a lot. This will help us to be able to read the financials a little bit better because we'll be working off numbers that are more relevant that we just pulled out of the sky.
Might help to get audits done more than 2 years in arrears.
Well, that cost a lot of money to have it drag out like that.
Precisely.
So I say we accept the warrants with the modifications occurring at the next board meeting.
As described in the warrant summary, however, with the notation that the check numbers given are district assigned control numbers and are not actually the bank check numbers. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 4-0 with one absent.
Mr. Vice President, we are approaching 10 o'clock right about now.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to continue past 10 o'clock. Hearing none.
No, the motion to extend for another half hour.
I second that.
It's been moved and seconded to extend the meeting past 10 o'clock. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion fails on a 2-2 vote. The meeting's adjourned.